Welcome, everyone, to episode 429 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek. We are now two games into every first round playoff series, so we're going to take stock of where things stand for each team, preview game threes, and the big adjustments we expect to see moving forward. Before we get into that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. We're being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. We're recording our show today on Locker Room, the only live audio social network for sports fans. Listen to our show on Locker Room before it hits your iTunes feed. Engage with us in real time, or start your own room to react to the draft, trade news, and more. Take the mic and download Locker Room in the Apple App Store. Joining me today is a guy who is thankfully 7,000 miles away, so he cannot spit on me or throw popcorn at me. Morton Jensen, how are you?
Well, I've been better. I'm pretty pissed about that, actually. I think as an NBA community, we need to do better. And I understand that you and I were fine, and the vast majority of NBA fans are perfectly reasonable human beings. I understand that. But for the few that aren't, for the few that decides, hey, let me spit on a human being because he wears different sports colors than I do, or hey, let me just drench a guy who just left the court injured in popcorn because that's what I feel like, that's completely unacceptable. And Brian, it's also not lost on me that it was two white fans doing this towards black players. And I can't help but wonder, if the roles have been reversed, what would the media picture had looked like right now? I am so fed up with this kind of behavior. I'm just so fed up with it. It's inexcusable. And people who afterwards attacked Russell Westbrook when he said that the league needs to do something. I mean, otherwise, like, I would have gone in there. Like, why the hell are you attacking this guy? He's allowed to stand up for himself first and foremost. Secondarily, if that's the treatment that he's getting from fans, I don't blame him whatsoever if at one point he loses his utter shit and goes into the stands. And I'd be rooting for his ass to win.
Yeah.
It is. It's, yeah, go on.
There should just be like a blanket policy of if you are dumb enough to do something like that, the NBA player should be able to fight you one-on-one because you would get your ass absolutely handed to you. And you deserve every second of it. It just, you're totally right. Like, there's just always one idiot that ruins it for everyone. And, you know, it's the combination of alcohol and just bad behavior in general do not mix. So, like, I don't want anyone to conflate all Knicks fans with one idiot who spits on Trae Young or all Philly fans, the one idiot who spills popcorn. And I'm glad that both teams have banned those people from the arenas indefinitely. That is the correct punishment. You don't deserve a second chance when you're that dumb.
Well, it should be permanently. I really had a problem with indefinitely.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that means permanently. I can't imagine.
Well, then say that. Yeah. Like, just ban for life. Yeah. Like, that would send a message, wouldn't it?
I hope so, and I hope that's what they do, because those people do not deserve to attend NBA games. If that's how you're going to behave.
No, I just mean in the press release. Yeah. Like, if you said in the press release, right out, banned for life, like, oh boy, that would hit harder, I think, than indefinitely.
Yeah.
It's like, you don't need to pull your punches here, Madison Square Garden. Like, just, or Philadelphia 76ers for that matter. Like, just go on, say it.
Yeah.
Banned for life.
Yeah. And, you know, fan behavior was, even before last night with Kyrie, after game two, talking about going to Boston and saying, like, he just hopes the fans aren't racist. Like, we have a very low baseline of just don't be a complete dick when you're at an NBA game and you're going to be better than that lowest common denominator. Like, this is not, just treat NBA players how you would like to be treated. You can boo them, you can make fun of them for their on-court abilities and talents. If they airball, go right ahead and mock them for that. But treat them like people. Like, you would not like it if someone came to your job and spit on you or dumped popcorn on you or called you, you know, a racist name, anything like that. So just, you have to remember, yes, they're being paid millions of dollars, but at the same time, they are humans as well. Treat them with the baseline of respect that they deserve.
Yeah. I respect the hell out of Kyrie for saying what he did.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, I'm naive, Brian, so I didn't understand the backlash of that, because I don't think anyone clapping back at Kyrie had a leg to stand.
No, not like, at all.
How can you be against something so logical?
Right.
Like, hey, guys, please don't be racist towards us. Oh, what the hell? Like, what? It doesn't make sense.
I don't know if you noticed, but Boston fans don't like being called racist. And so I knew the second he said that, there was going to be some comical backlash that's just completely misplaced.
It's actually funny you said that, because The Daily Show just did a segment on Boston sports fans and racism.
Oh, really?
Which I can link to you. Oh, yeah, I can link it to you after our podcast.
Interesting. All right. Well, hopefully we get no more boorish behavior from fans, because we have...
Yes.
So far in the first round, we have some very good playoff series going for the most part. Let's just start more in order that we're going to see these game threes unfold. So it starts tonight, 7:30 Eastern, Milwaukee-Miami. The first game was super close. The second game was anything but. Milwaukee buries them in an avalanche of threes. Now Miami is down 0-2. Going back home, and this is basically the series right here. If Milwaukee goes up 3-0, they are not coming back from it. So, Mort, what do you think the Heat need to do to get back into this series? And does it involve Jimmy Butler getting smartly locked in?
Oh, see, you took it away. Had you just stopped the question, what should the Miami Heat do? I was going to say they should get stupidly locked in.
It's not worked so far.
In game one, I think they were locked in, especially defensively. Yeah. I just think offensively they, like, this has been such a great defensive series from the Bucks as well.
Yes.
I mean, this is kind of what we wanted them to look like, right? Like, in game one, okay, there were a little bit of a residue for the last 2 years, really, mm-hmm. but they overcame it. And again, that was because of the play of Jrue Holiday in particular, which is why they traded for him. So, first leg, that right there, that goes to Milwaukee. They overcame it. And since second game, they look like the team that we've been looking forward to seeing for a couple years now. Dominant, dominant, dominant. So for them, it's about just maintaining that level of play. But if they do, then I don't know what the answer is that the Heat can do to adjust. I don't think there is an adjustment to be made. You can try the Luka Doncic mentality of saying, okay, let's just double Giannis as much as you can, but what does that really help you? I mean, then you have Drew, you have Chris Middleton, both of whom can make plays or score for themselves if they want to. There's going to be a guy open. Hell, Giannis has really improved at playing double teams, really, just understanding, oh, if the help comes from a certain angle on the floor, that means the secondary rotator is going to come from there, so if I go right here before the double team hits me, I know that the pass is open in the corner. Like, he's smart. He's a smart basketball player. He will overcome a double team. I don't know if it's just me, but I think double teaming smart players, which we've seen a lot in these playoffs, has to be one of the dumbest plays still around in the NBA. Mm-hmm. I don't really understand the merit of it. So you can't really go that route. So what can you do? Okay, if you don't want to shut down Giannis, you want to do the Jokic treatment and just give him the green light, sure. But here's the thing, giving Giannis the green light and giving him the ability to go for 50, that's not a great idea either,
right?
Because he's a guy who shoots so effectively, especially around the basket, that that's not going to be one of those games where he scores 50 but on 41 shots.
Yeah.
No, that's him scoring 50 on like 26 shots.
Right.
And that type of efficiency is not going to help you at all. So I don't know what the answer is. I think I would lean to something else entirely, and that's Miami just going balls out offensively, actually. Just screw defense for a game. Just go crazy. Get the ball into the teeth of the defense in Milwaukee, or with Milwaukee's defender. Get Duncan going from the outside. Get Jimmy, like, really going in the first quarter. Like, get him off to, like, a 17-18-point first quarter. Get Bam involved, but I still don't trust that play. I don't trust that to be working. So, yeah, it's quite the Mount Everest for Miami.
Yeah, it's looking bleak for them. I mean, I think this one stat really sums up the series as a whole right now. Bryn Forbes and Jimmy Butler have scored the same number of points in this series. They have both scored 27 points through two games.
Oh, boy, that's tough. Yeah. Okay.
So,
yeah, that is tough.
If you've got Jimmy Butler shooting 25% from the field, which he is in this series, You're drawing dead.
Yeah.
It's as easy as that. I think the adjustment that I would expect to see is Goran Dragic possibly moving into the starting lineup in Game 3. I just don't know that it matters all that much. I mean,
that's putting lipstick on a pig. Yeah.
I think we said, you know, going into the series, the addition of Jrue Holiday in Milwaukee, the subtraction of Jay Crowder in Miami, that could make all the difference. You know, Bud being willing to play the starters 40 minutes in Game 1 during, you know, regulation was something he wasn't willing to do until way too late last year. Putting Giannis on Jimmy right away defensively. Like, the Bucks learned from that series last year. And, you know, the Heat are a worse team than they were last year. You know, maybe they get super hot from deep, but, I mean, that I feel like Game 1 was their chance. If you outshoot Miami by 45 from deep and you don't win that game, you're probably not going to have an opportunity as good as that again. So, you know, if updated prediction for this series, to me, I'm looking like Bucks in 5 probably. I could see Miami winning one of these two at home and then the Bucks taking the other one and just slamming the door in Game 5.
I wouldn't be shocked if it's a flat-on sweep.
No, I wouldn't either. And it's going to raise some very interesting questions for Miami. We'll get to their by Felicia very likely pretty soon. But, I mean, they will have some flexibility moving forward, so it's not a total disaster. But, man.
Well, I have one name I'm looking at because, you know, was it 3 years ago that I argued that I wanted Kawhi and Jimmy Butler on the same team?
We'll save it. We'll save it for the by Felicia because I'm hoping the All NBA teams will come out by then. That has a big influence on what Miami can do this summer.
That is true.
All right, so let's turn our attention now, Mort, to Phoenix Lakers. We got Game 2 at 10 o'clock tonight. The Lakers came back, won Game 2, 109-102. Anthony Davis shed the playoff AD label that he earned in Game 1 by actually performing well, 34 points, 10 rebounds. Drummond also was not as much of a disaster, 15 points, 12 rebounds in only 24 minutes. Marc Gasol, they dusted him off in this game, which was nice to see. But ultimately, the storyline is Chris Paul and his shoulder. He only played 23 minutes in Game 2 and just did not look at all like his normal self. So, you know, Devin Booker was great again, 31 points. He had 17 free throw attempts, hit every single one of them. DeAndre Ayton, again, great game, 22 points on 11 of 13, shooting 10 rebounds. But more without Chris Paul, are the Suns in a lot of trouble here?
Yeah, they are. So I said after Game 1 that I thought the Lakers were closer to the panic button than the Clippers. I still maintain that was the case if they lost Game 2. Mm-hmm. They didn't. The fact that they came back and won Game 2 completely changed the series. Mm-hmm. I do think it's interesting that it wasn't a blowout in Game 2. I am looking at that going, the Suns kept it somewhat close, overall, at least, without the presence of Chris Paul being 100%. Mm-hmm. I think that is an interesting subplot moving forward. And if Paul suddenly begins to feel better, because it seems like it's one of those injuries that can feel a lot better just with a little bit of time, then that this series could turn. I have no idea like what's going to happen in this series, which makes it extremely interesting, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so this was the quote from Monty Williams. He said he played 23 minutes, 7 minutes in the second half. And Monty Williams said, I took him out. That was all me. Just looking at him holding the arm the way he was holding it, I couldn't watch him run like that, trying to make plays. He's battled. He's a warrior. We all know that. I just made a decision to take him out. He wasn't on the injury report Tuesday, which I thought was funny because clearly he was hurt. But apparently he was looking better in practice and shoot around. And I guess just when the game started, it wasn't so much. So, yeah, it's just we don't know what to expect from Chris Paul in this Game 3 or in the series moving forward. Right. You know, I think the Lakers should be favored to win this series now, especially with the uncertainty surrounding Chris Paul. Like, even if they win tonight and go up 2-1, you're right. If Chris Paul, if those extra couple days help him recover, I guess that's a question. and it's going to sound probably somewhat stupid, but like, depending on the prognosis of the injury, if a couple days of rest would really help, should the Suns just not play Chris Paul in game three, give him a little extra time, and just hope that heals him enough that we're back closer to 100% for game four and the rest of the series?
Yeah, absolutely. If that's what it takes, you would rather have one game where you don't play him at all if you can get some version of him that's like 80% compared to what he is now, which is like, what, 30% at best? Like, if you can increase those odds dramatically by having him sit down for a single game, absolutely you should. Yes. Then you run the offense through Devin Booker, you get DeAndre Ayton more shots, because apparently he just can't miss. And then you figure out what the hell to do with Jay Crowder, because apparently he can miss. He can miss a whole lot. look, 7.7% from the free this series, right? I definitely make that gamble, because I don't even think it is a gamble. Like, you could even make the argument that if you put Paul out there playing at 30% than what he is, that he actually unintentionally, of course, hurts the team just by being out there. So, yeah, of course, I sit him down for a game if that evens the playing field a little bit more. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the tricky part is, like, Cameron Payne played well in his stead on Tuesday. He had 19.7 assists in 33 minutes, and he's been a nice story all season. But do they have the playmaking chops without Chris Paul to last for a full game? Can you lean more on Devin Booker as a playmaker? Can you know, Booker, Payne, you know, Dario Saric, could run a little bit more of the offense through him? Like, do they have enough to keep pace with the Lakers, who really have not been going gangbusters offensively in this series so far?
Right. Yes, they do. Absolutely. Look, it's one game. Devin Booker, was it last season, averaged like 6.5 dimes or something along those lines? It was pretty insane. Yeah, 6.5. And the year before, he was at almost 7. I completely missed that. And it's not just the raw assist. Like, he is a high-caliber playmaker. I think the reason we don't think of Booker that way, and again, this really boils back. I've said this repeatedly on the show, but it bothers me, like, how the pre-draft comps, like, always stick. Like, for him, it was Klay Thompson, and he's just not that guy. I mean, he's more of a playmaker, he's more of a pick-and-roll guy than he's a spot-up shooter. So, and I think he is just so good on the ball as a play initiator, as someone who can get his own offense going. If you just lay Booker as your lead guard throughout an entire game, and like you said, have Cameron Payne back him up, you give the ball a little bit more to Dario Saric, maybe you try to funnel more shots onto the wings with Jay Crowder and Mikal Bridges, and of course DeAndre Ayton near the basket, I think you could survive. Would you win? I don't know. Could you keep it close? Absolutely, no doubt in my mind.
Alright, so let's now move to the other game tonight. Denver-Portland, after the Game 1 upset from Portland, where they limited Jokic to only one assist. Jokic still didn't have a huge game in terms of playmaking, but he had a huge game otherwise with 38 points. His teammates also really came through. We got 18 from Michael Porter Jr., 15 from Paul Millsap off the bench, 12 from Monte Morris, 12 from Facundo Campazzo, 13 from Aaron Gordon. Meanwhile, Damian Lillard was sensational in the first half, finishes with 42 points, 10 assists, but they switch Aaron Gordon onto him in the second half, and I have these stats from Royce Young of ESPN.com. So first half, Lillard had 32 points, he had 8 threes. Second half, he hit only 1 three once Gordon switched onto him. So I think it's safe to say we'll probably see more of that matchup as the series moves forward. More, what do the Blazers need to do to counter that?
So, of course, when you have someone of that size on Lillard, you also have to figure that he tires out a little bit more easily. So I think in the first quarter, if he comes out, Aaron Gordon, like, starts the game up guarding Dame, I would run him through a load of screens. I would try to tire him out just a little bit. And I would even do it like sort of as a decoy play, I wouldn't even be looking necessarily to getting the ball to Dame a whole lot if I know that he's on his ass. But, I mean, if he can rid himself of Gordon on those screens, I would. But no, I've just generally run him tired and run him wrecked. Mm-hmm. I think that's the play, especially if they started up early. I don't think they will for that particular reason. I think they will like kind of save that for the end of games, very similar to back in 2011 when LeBron like guarded Derrick Rose, mm-hmm. if you remember that. Like, it wasn't something they started out with. It was something they ended games with, which I think was a brilliant move. So I think that would be the line that they'd take. But, yeah, just run him through screens, set a lot of hard picks on him as well. I think that's the play forward, because he is quick enough, Aaron Gordon, to stick with Dame if it's just isolation.
Yeah, so, and Lillard said after the game he does expect that matchup to continue the way he plans to counter it, is moving around more off the ball, getting more off-ball sets. He said usually bigger guys can use their length and athleticism on the ball, but when you start to move around on flares and pin downs and things like that, typically you can get a little bit of space. So you were spot.
And that's all he needs.
Yeah, right, exactly. As we've learned repeatedly throughout the years. So yeah, you're spot on there. Also, I mean, it's going to open the door. If Gordon's on Lillard, that means he's not on CJ McCollum and Norman Powell. So those two guys, you know, look, they're still starting Austin Rivers and Facundo Campacho. So whoever those two guys are guarding, those are the ones you got to target offensively.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Target Austin Rivers, especially, from just relentlessly.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, the Blazers have the personnel to make things work. You know, they got a tough night out of Nurkic. He only had 7 points on 2 of 8 shooting. McCollum was good, but only took 12 shots. He had 21 points, but only on 9 of 12 shooting. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see more offense from some of these complimentary guys in Game 3. Yeah. But so far, this series is shaping up to be, you know, one of the longer ones in the first round. I think these teams, despite the scores being somewhat lopsided in games 1 and 2, I think they're pretty evenly matched. And, you know, it's going to be a fascinating series of adjustments, especially. Like, you know, we talked a couple weeks or a month or two ago about, you know, the report that Terry Stotts is basically coaching for his job in this series. So this is, you know, game 3, when the Nuggets have already thrown their big adjustment at you, this is where you earn your money and earn your job security, is if you can come up with a counterpunch to that.
It also feels like Melo's due, right?
Well, he had a great game 1.
He did. That's true. Okay. Yeah, I was thinking like one of those 29, 30 pointers, but maybe that's me putting a little bit too much stock in it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, going back home, role players tend to shoot better. So I think the Nugget or the Blazers could have that in their back pocket. Like, maybe fueled by the crowd, Melo does have a vintage Melo game. But I also don't think he's just going to play enough. You know, I would be surprised if he's playing enough minutes to put up 29 or 30 points unless he just hits every single shot he throws up, which is always possible.
It just feels like twice a month or something, he just goes out and he's like vintage Melo.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah. You know what? I'll actually give you that. Game 1. You know what? I think that's fair to bring that up. Maybe that is now the new vintage Melo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you catch my maybe that's like
18, like
him shooting 50%, 18
in 22 minutes. Yeah, exactly. You know, it's almost a point a minute.
Yeah. Well. Yeah, and he's 36. Maybe I need to lay off the expectations here. He'll be 37 in 2 days.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, I think, like, Nurkic in game 1 had 16 points on 7 of 10 shooting. So getting him back, I just think they need, you know, it can't just be the Dame show, especially if the Nuggets are throwing their best perimeter defender on him. That's going to open things up for these other guys. And Nurkic has to battle with Nikola Jokic, who, you know, he's not an elite defensively, but he's still got the size to make life difficult. So, yeah, I mean, the Blazers, it's got to come down to the supporting cast for them. But I think they have that type of personnel where if those guys are hitting shots, they can certainly do it.
Can we give Robert Covington more than 8 shots in 71 minutes?
Is he going to hit more than... I mean, that's...
He's hitting 50%?
I know. It's
super small sample size, but I don't know. I just... Look, we've talked about this before on this podcast. I'm very disappointed in how that trade turned out.
Yeah.
You and I were so high on the Robert Covington to Portland idea. Just from a theoretical standpoint, we were like, oh, this could be the missing piece. And he's just been very, very underwhelming from an offensive perspective, at the least.
Yeah, I mean, he's just always been streaky. He is who he is at this point. He's not having a Jeremy...
Yeah, but this is something else, right?
Yeah, like, he's not going to have a Jeremy Grant-esque leap. Like, you know, you're asking him to just hit catch-and-shoot threes, basically. He can't create off the dribble for himself, or you certainly don't want him to. But, yeah, the volume... isn't what you would hope, I guess.
Right. I mean, look, from a scoring perspective, like, you got to give me this. Even if you go back to the regular season, like, this was his worst scoring output of his career if we ignore his 7-game rookie season.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I expected more. Yeah. I understand he's streaky. Totally hear you on that. I didn't expect 8.5 points per game.
Yeah. Yeah. The volume went down, too. You know, he took...
Exactly. Of course. Well, that's what I'm saying, that he didn't feature. Yeah. I kind of want him to feature a little bit more, because if you have a non-scorer or non-shooter in there for 36 minutes per game, which you have right now in the first-round series, that becomes very easy to ignore. Yeah. And then you're playing 4-on-5 basketball for essentially 3 quarters.
Right, exactly. All right, let's turn our attention now. Those are Thursday's games, so let's move to Friday's slate. First game on the agenda, Knicks-Hawks. And man, I mean, I was watching Sixers-Wizards for most of last night and just following Knicks-Hawks on Twitter, but based on the reaction from the first half, it sounded like the Knicks were just completely drawing dead. Then they turn it around in the second half. Julius Randle wakes up. We get some big shot-making. The Hawks, you know, kudos to them for keeping it close, but the Knicks ended up pulling that game out with a big second-half surge, tie the series up at 1 game apiece. What do you think the keys are for the Knicks to keep that momentum going into Game 3?
More efficient offense. Like, honestly, I know that's a really simplistic answer, but... your best player is shooting 28% from the floor. RJ Barrett is shooting under 38. Emmanuel Quickley is shooting 37. Those are probably three of your best offensive players on the team. So I think it would kind of behoove them to get that offense going. As a team, they're shooting 41.5%, for crying out loud. They need to have the offensive efficiency. Defensively, I understand that because of the presence of Tips, they play on a string, they rotate the right ways, but individually, I don't think there are a whole lot of great defenders on the Knicks outside of Nerlens Noel, so their calling card cannot be exclusively defense, especially matched up against a Hawks team that is this potent offensively and have so many weapons. They need to be able to respond offense with offense, fight fire with fire just a little bit of the way. So for them, get easy shots. I want to see them take it into the paint. I want to see them draw contact. I want to see them get Clint Capela in foul trouble, forcing Onyeka Okongwu, who's a rookie, or John Collins, who, by the way, we need to talk about what the hell happened in Game 2 on that front.
Foul trouble.
Just, yeah, right? But also, like, even foul trouble, just an offer, an egg, really?
Yeah, I mean, he played only 15 minutes.
Still, though, that's over a quarter. Yeah.
No, I know.
I mean, but my point here is you need to be able to put the ball in the basket. At the end of the day, the team with the most points wins, and then you can have all your standards about great defense or whatever, and that's nice. You need that. But right now, the offensive execution from the Knicks have been pretty dismal. Like, 2 bench players are leading the team in scoring here in the playoffs.
Yeah, well, it was nice to see Tibbs stop screwing around with Elfin Payton in the second half, at least. He started Derrick Rose.
Yes.
So we were skeptical over whether he would ever make that adjustment, even though Payton played 5 minutes in that game, too, and he was a -7, which at a certain point, like, it, you know, you just got to I know you got, Derek like coming off the bench and that he's used to it. He's a, NBA players are creatures of habit, but Elfrid Payton's giving you nothing. He's got to, he should not be playing in this series. He should just be excised from the rotation. Rose should start, rely on Burks and Quickly as your main guards off the bench. It's as easy as that.
38 minutes per game for Derrick Rose in the first two games.
Derrick's been very good. Taj Gibson also. The joke when the Knicks acquired these guys was like, oh, great, it's Tibbs guys again for the fourth straight team or whatever. But, both of those guys have made the Knicks wouldn't be in the position that they're in without those two guys.
Yeah. And that's what I said going into the playoffs as well. I think that is one of the things that Tibbs kind of relies upon. Like, those two are extended arms of Tibbs out there,
yeah,
to a certain extent. They know how to execute his play style. They know what they want. Like, it just makes sense to play them extended minutes. But at the end of the day, Brian, we just cannot get out of the fact that Julius Randle needs to be better offensively.
Yeah, he was really, really struggling that first half. Did start to get things going a little bit in the second half, which is good to see. Collins being in foul trouble certainly helped in that regard. You can't necessarily bank on that moving forward. One wild card to keep an eye on, it sounds like Mitchell Robinson is at least getting close to a return. So, I don't...
Does that help the Knicks or does that help the Hawks?
It's another body with six fouls, if nothing else.
That's true, but I'm thinking if he's going to absorb some of the minutes from Nerlens Noel... Mm-hmm.
Or Taj.
I probably would go with those two.
Well, Nerlens came in questionable with a sprained ankle last night, only played 17 minutes, so we'll see what his status is moving forward. I don't think he's going to be able to gut out 30-plus minutes on that. So maybe
that's
Robinson can just fill in there. I don't think Robinson's coming in going to play, 25, 30 minutes right out the gate. Like, he's, you can turn to him in foul trouble if Noel or Gibson get into early foul trouble, or just play him for, 10 minutes. But it's just something to keep an eye on as the series goes on. This is also shaping up so far. I mean, it's shaping up to be probably at least a six-gamer, right?
Yeah, I would think so. I got to give the Hawks credit, though. They came into New York and did what they needed to do.
Yeah.
And they won a game. I mean, a split is not bad. Obviously, if you're Hawks fans, you really wanted to see them squeeze out game two, much like Dallas did in LA. Mm-hmm. But, you take this every single day of the week.
Yeah. No, I still think the Hawks are the better team here, and I would feel pretty good about their chances moving forward. From a Sixers perspective, I'm hoping like hell that the Knicks win this series, because I'm much more scared of the Hawks than I am of the Knicks in the next round. But
you are so scared all the time. Is that Fox mentioning it to you?
I watched two of the Sixers' five starters sprain their ankle last night. I live in constant fear.
By the way, I got a question here, because I am not really up to speed when it comes to which teams are allowing back fans. That's been a subplot I just haven't followed very closely. The Hawks, are they allowing fans back in now?
I mean, they're in the South, so I'm assuming they think the pandemic's over.
Yeah, but full on. I mean, are we talking about... I know they allowed a minor crowd early in the year, but are we fully fledged, playoff go, full house?
I don't know. I'm not paying attention to which team. I mean, from what I've seen, most teams are around 50% capacity, so I don't know how many are allowed at each stadium, but I would assume at least 10,000.
Yeah, and the reason I'm asking, because that place is going to be jumping.
Oh, yeah. No, this has been a really fun series in terms of, building a new rivalry between... with Trey, especially in the first couple games. And, speaking of bad fan behavior, the Knicks chanting Trey is balding last night. Again, let's do better here, folks. Come on, just make fun of him flopping. That's one thing. Let's not make fun of his receding hairline.
Also, just one final note here. Why is it that Trey is the villain exactly?
Well, he's the best player on the team, and, you know, again, did the, like, finger shushing with the game winner in game one. So,
can you be a villain when the team you're playing against is owned by James Dolan?
Yeah, I know. It's been interesting to see how that one game has people, like, ready to anoint him as, you know, is he ready to embrace the villain role that, like, LeBron and KD shied away from? And maybe he is, and that'd be cool, because it's, you know, it is fun to root against players who, like, you know, it's like the WWE. Like, you know, when someone openly embraces being a heel and feeds into that energy, it's really fun to root against that. But
and for them, for crying out loud.
Right. Oh, absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, I'm interested to see how that develops over the rest of this series, too. Like, if he hits another game winner and, you know, has some extra theatrics for Knicks fans, I could certainly see that not going over super well. Mm.
Gallo needs to drop the mohawk, right?
I saw a story. Apparently, he promised someone on the staff that if they made the playoffs, he was going to do it. But, he was
shooting 24%.
Yeah, he looks terrible. There is not much to say about Boston-Brooklyn that we didn't already expect in this series. You know, the Nets are just, without Jalen Brown, the Celtics just do not have the talent to match up against the Brooklyn Nets. So we will, I'm actively preparing there by Felicia as we speak. Instead, more, I think we should just turn our attention to a Nets-centric theme here. The Nets announced today that Jeff Green has strained his plantar fascia and will be reevaluated in 10 days, which means he's... Malika Andrews of ESPN says he's sidelining him for the remainder of the first round series. Like, I don't know if that would be true if the series is going seven, but I just like that we're assuming he is definitely out for the rest of that series. But how much are the Nets going to miss Jeff Green? Again, not, they're going to beat the Celtics regardless of whether they have Jeff Green, but looking ahead, especially assuming the Bucks move on in that Bucks Nets series, how much would they miss Jeff if he continues to miss time there?
Oh, they'll miss him quite a lot, actually, because one thing is you can put Alize Johnson in there who can absorb some of his minutes, but he doesn't have the fluidity of Jeff Green's game. Mm. Jeff can play sort of like this small ball five, like small ball four, like as well, like those two big spots really where he shoots and dribbles and gets into the offense and like initiates the offense. You can't ask Alize Johnson to do that. You can't ask Nicholas Claxton to do that. You can't really ask anyone to do that outside of Jeff Green in that particular role. So you're going to be missing out on ball handling. You're going to be missing out on having that very fluid element who can seek out three-point shots and like drives to the basket. Like, he may not give you a ton of points, he may not give you a ton of numbers generally speaking, but his presence on the court, being able to handle the ball, being able to drive, being able to spot up, it just provides him with so much movement. And like I said, that word fluidity, I think that is the best word to use with him. I really don't know what they should do without him. Like, they could get crazy and try Landry Shamet in that role, but I'm like, he doesn't have the height. I mean, he wouldn't be able to duplicate what Green does. So, I don't know. I think that would be a loss. I don't think necessarily it would prevent the Nets from doing anything good, but no, they would feel it. It would definitely be, you know, a gut punch. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know that that's, like, the difference maker in the series, but you're right. His versatility is really important to what the Nets do, especially if they don't want to play, you know, DeAndre Jordan as a traditional center, specifically against Brook Lopez. You know, we'll see if they'll stick with this starting lineup that they've been rolling with Blake Griffin as their center. And they, you know, Lord knows they've used Bruce Brown in that 6'4 Bruce Brown in the big man role as well. They have Nick Claxton too. So they have options, but Jeff's versatility is really a nice piece for them. And, you know, for his sake, it'd be a bummer if he misses that series, because I want those two teams at absolute full strength. Like, I am ready to sim to end of both Nets Celtics and Heat Bucks, because we know how these things are going to end. And I do not, it would just absolutely suck if, like, one of the big pieces on either one of those teams misses time and, you know, we don't get the full strength version, because that is shaping up as an all-time great playoff series.
It'd be the funniest thing ever if Boston came back into the series and won it just so I can take that soundbite of yours.
Oh, my God.
Knowing full well, it would be Boston that won it as well, just to add more salt to the wound.
Hey, I'm rooting for the Celtics. Go Celtics. I'm a huge Celtics fan. I hope the Celtics and the Heat both win these series.
You have no guts, man. You don't really want to meet the best.
No, I do not. I want a cakewalk to the finals, please. All right. We have... the next one on the agenda.
Yeah.
Clippers-Dallas. Clippers are going into Dallas, down 0-2. And you referenced the panic button earlier where I asked you, after game one, should they be at the panic button? You said, no, it's only one game.
Nope.
How are you feeling now?
Oh, you saw my tweet. You saw my tweet. I sent you a GIF of the panic button being hit repeatedly. No, they should be in panic mode, according to Paul George. They're not, which, okay, good on them. But this was bad. This was really bad, because you know what? When we spoke the last time around, we started talking about Kawhi Leonard needing to come out and get a tremendous first quarter and go for 40. Mm-hmm. What happened? That exact thing happened. We said they should switch a little bit less, that they should double significantly less on Luka. That also happened, Brian. And you know what? They still walked away with an L, because Luka is just that good, and Tim Hardaway is just that good at punishing them, the Clippers, that is, for not paying enough attention to him, because they're so keyed in on Luka and his passing options. Yeah. I mean, this is a clinic of basketball IQ from the Dallas perspective. And I will say this. Both of these games were winnable for the Clippers if they had just played a little bit more disciplined defense.
Yes.
And I think I realized something watching game two. The Clippers don't have a plan for when they double Luka.
Yeah.
And that's where I think they come up short. Like, if you double Luka, you need to know exactly what you are going to do in terms of rotations on the back line. You have to understand where you double from, what that means. Everybody has to be on a defensive string. And they're just not, Brian. Like, it's, hey, I'm gonna double off of Tim Hardaway Jr., who just cashed in his fifth
here
a couple of moments ago. Let me just run away from him, and nobody else steps up to guard him. Boom. Easy pass. There goes the three-point. I mean, boom goes the dynamite. That's where we are. I'm completely baffled at what the hell Tyronn Lue is even doing right now from an X's and O's perspective. I do not get it.
Yeah. No, I'm so glad you said that, because they cut the lead to 4 with a minute and a half left, and you're thinking, okay, they've got the momentum, right? They cut a double-digit lead down to 4. They still have plenty of time on the clock. They throw a double at Luka. Tim Hardaway, as you said, is just wide-ass open. Tim Hardaway Jr., who burned them in the first game, who had already hit 5 threes in this game. It's just inexcusable. You're right. It's like they just don't seem... I don't know if it's a game plan issue. Like, Ty Lue kind of alluded to the fact that they just didn't execute their game plan like they wanted to. If it's just communication breakdowns, between personnel on the court. And maybe this is, again, a time where all of their injuries throughout the regular season have limited their chemistry, especially defensively. But it's really bad. And, they got... Kristaps had a bad game in game one. He was, 20 points on 8 of 12 shooting in game two. He stepped up as well. So,
well, I don't disagree that he did, but it was really one of those very, very... You didn't feel like he had 20, if you catch my drift. It felt like he finished the game with 12.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't a loud 20. So I understand what you're saying, and he was productive, but I do think that's the next step. That's him getting implemented a little bit more and not having to settle for scraps.
Right. That's what's scary is that, in theory, we've seen the version of Kristaps who can be far more dominant than what he's been in this series. And, the Mavericks have gotten 2 wins even without that. And now they're going home. The Clippers are feeling a ton of pressure down 0-2. Their supporting cast has just not played super well. Kawhi and Paul George, yeah, PG went 1 of 7 from three, but, you know, he had 28 points, 12 rebounds, 6 assists, played 40 minutes. Like, it's...
Yeah, he was fine.
Yeah, it's not... This is not a playoff P revival again. It's... They just don't seem to have the personnel to match up well with Luka. I mean, Luka, again, is still getting switched on to Zubac at times. That should...
Yeah.
We said it last episode, we'll say it again. That should never happen. You have Paul George and Kawhi Leonard. Stick to Luka like glue with one of those two guys at all times and live with the results. But, I'll say this much. Mm-hmm. Because of how the, you know, a year ago, we're looking at the 2021 free agent class and we're thinking this could be historic. Giannis, LeBron, yeah. Paul George, Kawhi, Gobert, Drew Holiday, like Kyle Lowry, DeMar DeRozan, so many big names. Almost all of those guys are off the market already, with the exception of Lowry and DeRozan. And Kawhi. And now...
And Kawhi.
I'm not saying that Kawhi will definitely leave the Clippers if they lose this series. But if you're Kawhi, you at least have to... They've wasted 2 years of your prime now. And you just don't know how much more you're going to have, especially with your knee. You know, we don't know the status of it moving forward and if it's a concern, but, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if it is and they're just keeping that hush-hush. You got to at least start looking around this summer, and that's going to spice things up significantly, you know, just for the NBA at large. So, I think...
Well, that depends, Brian. If I'm Kawhi Leonard, do I have... Do I have the permission from Uncle Dennis to look?
Good point. Hopefully, because it really could. That could be like the jet fuel that we need in this otherwise kind of lame free agent class. And there are like the Mavericks are sitting out there, and they could create $35 million in space.
Yeah. Now you're talking like that. Now you're speaking my language there, Brian. Because that's what I want. I think. If you look at the Clippers, what they need, right? One thing is that they need guard play.
Yeah.
But they need something else we haven't even touched on. They need leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Who right there on that roster right now is the leader?
I mean, they said last year that it was all Doc Rivers' fault, and so far I'm seeing it was perhaps not all Doc Rivers' fault.
Right. So, again, who's there? Like, when Kawhi was in Toronto... Who was the leader there? Kyle Lowry. Kyle Lowry was the leader. Who is that guy right now? Rajon Rondo? No. Reggie Jackson? Mm-mm. Patrick Beverley? Nope.
Marcus Morris?
Morris? No. And you know what Luka is, strangely enough? A leader.
Yeah.
22 years old and a natural-born leader. Maybe, just maybe, getting Kawhi onto the Dallas Mavericks would extend his... window for championship for at least another 5 years, and it might play straight into his hand because all of the attention that goes to Luka. Could you imagine Kawhi just enjoying that, playing under the radar?
No, I mean
taking spot up threes, taking open drives.
Like I don't know which one of those two would be the number one or the number two, but that's immediately right up there with LeBron and AD and KD and Harden as the best 1-2 punch in the league. Yep. And I don't know where I'd rank them, those three duos, honestly.
And here's the kicker. If you do that, maybe just because they have such a good relationship, maybe you get a Tim Hardaway back on a much cheaper contract just for a single year. Just like, come get a ring, then you can go into free agency afterwards. Like maybe he goes, you know what? I'm down with that. I earned $72 million because the Knicks signed me to that deal. I can take a year where I just go for the ring. Sure.
Or if you...
I don't know. I'm just saying.
Again, we'll speculate about Kawhi's future at a later date if they end up losing the series, but that is the perspective now, and I think it's the perspective the Clippers fans have to take while watching this as well. Is like, when you acquire Paul George and Kawhi Leonard in that deal 2 years ago, you know, hey, I know Paul... George said last year was not championship or bust. This year sure as hell is. Because even though Paul George is signed...
It was last year,
right,
too.
Right. You know, I get it. Pandemic, bubble, weird season, whatever. Paul George is signed to a contract extension, so the Clippers are not, You know, they won't be what, like, this year's Detroit Pistons if Kawhi leaves. But
right.
they also won't be, you know, they'll be a play-in team next year if Kawhi leaves. So this is championship or bust. You're down 0-2 going into Dallas. I mean, the pressure just might completely crack them, and I'm excited to see how they handle it.
This would be just such a weird career turn for Kawhi when you then look over his past, like, 5 years.
Yeah.
Like, getting into a year-long fight with the Spurs, going to Toronto, winning the championship in the 1 year that he's there, then going to a Clippers team that everyone thought would win the ring, completely not bottom out. They didn't bottom out, but they would just fail to live up to expectations for 2 years, and then he would go somewhere else in 2021. That would be one of the weirdest, like, 5 year stretches of any tier one superstar I can remember.
Yeah, for sure. I'm excited to see what happens in this. I think if you're talking about, like, impact on the NBA at large moving forward, no series has bigger potential implications than what happens in Dallas Clippers.
But can we stay with Luka just a little bit before we move on? I mean, we have to talk about him.
Oh, he's been sensational.
He's 22.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand. He's been in the league for 3 years. We're already accustomed to this level of execution from him. But, like, even when we take everything into account, he used to be a professional in Spain with Real Madrid, came over extremely seasoned, came over extremely ready, now is in his third year in the NBA. Like, let's not lose sight of the fact that this guy is only 22 years old, and he plays like he's been in the NBA playoffs and has 150 games worth of playoff experience under him. He is, like, did you see the way that he would maneuver a, what the hell was it? I think he maneuvered, like, a high screen and roll, came into the lane, and I think hit a layup. And then when he, ran back on defense, he was, like, smirking.
Yeah.
Like, to that extent. And it wasn't one of those, oh, I'm glad it went in. It was one of those, oh, I got them.
Yeah.
Kind of smirks, like, you know?
I'm a bad man.
And then he hit, I'm a bad man. And then he hit the one-footer, three-pointer. And he would, that wasn't a smirk afterward. That was a full-on grin. Like, y'all can't stop me even regardless of what you do.
Yeah.
And this is what this is the most scary thing to me if I'm looking at, like, Luka Doncic from an outside perspective. You could make the argument, Brian, that the Los Angeles Clippers, that is the one team in the NBA most geared up to stop him from a personnel perspective.
Yeah.
Paul George, Kawhi Leonard, Nicholas Batum, and Marcus Morris. Those are four wing defenders that you can rotate onto him. They even have Patrick Beverly at the guard you could switch up to as well. So if that unit cannot stop Luka Doncic, who the hell can?
You're going to call me a homer, but Ben Simmons is the one guy who I've seen successfully defend Luka.
That's fair, actually. That is a very, very good answer. I think I would buy stock into that. That is absolutely fair. But look, it's still, that is one guy.
I know.
If four guys, one of whom have won a DP, I think two, was it one or two DPOY awards?
Kawhi.
I don't know if it's one. Yeah, but I know, but is it one or two?
Two.
It doesn't matter. He's one. Okay, yeah. Two. And then you had a DPOY finalist a couple years ago in Paul George when he was in OKC. So you have two DPOY, like, caliber players, and you can't stop Luka. I would rather take my chances with one DPOY candidate in Ben Simmons than those two. But I hear you. I mean, that if there's anyone out there who can, it's probably Ben. But that's it, I feel like. Like, even Thibault would
get
crushed. Yeah. Sorry.
Well, no. I mean, yeah, Ben has the right combination of size and athleticism, and I think that might be another subplot for Kawhi, and again goes back to his knee, is like, is he still the all-world caliber defender that he was a couple of years ago, or is Luka just a uniquely bad matchup for him?
Both.
Yeah.
Or how do we answer that on Twitter? We just say yes.
right. yes. Going into the series, we said the key for the Mavericks to win, you're going into a series against Kawhi Leonard and Paul George. Luka Doncic needs to be the best player. Through two games, he has been. We'll see if he can keep it up.
Yeah, and it hasn't even been close. No. And just to leave you on this note, if you bring in Ben Simmons against Luka in a seven-game series, I'm not convinced Luka doesn't figure him out.
Yeah, I'm not either. I wouldn't bet against Luka at all right now.
Yeah.
Since we just mentioned Ben, let's go to, strangely, so these are that was all Thursday and Friday slate. We get game four of Milwaukee, Miami, and Denver, Portland before we get to the game threes of the last two series, but we'll recover those. We'll go to game three, Philly, Washington. The Sixers just routed the Wizards in game two. Ben faced a lot of criticism after game one because he only scored 6 points, even though he had 15 rebounds, 15 assists, played great defense on Bradley Beal. It's the typical Ben Simmons storyline in a nutshell. Game two, he was much more aggressive as a scorer. He had 22 points, 9 rebounds, 8 assists. You know, the Sixers were just firing on all cylinders. We'll have to see the status of Tobias Harris. He had an ankle scare early, did come back to the game. Seth Curry injured his in the third quarter, did not come back, but that's probably because they were up 20 at the time. They didn't need him to. Russell Westbrook, as we mentioned at the top of the show, also got hurt, also an ankle. So ankles were just ban ankles from the Wells Fargo Center, I guess. But we'll see what his status is for game three. Do the Wizards have any counters that they can throw at the Sixers at this point?
They don't. And by the way, I'm super surprised you didn't open your entire Savada there by bringing up that Paul Reed played 5 minutes and had 4 points, 3 boards, and a
block. B-ball Paul, baby. Playoff B-ball Paul.
Oh, yeah. Okay, there we go. Playoff P. You really just... Right.
Well, going into the press conference last night, it was like, who do you even ask about? Like, everyone played well other than Shake Milton. Like, Doc, please talk about your entire roster. Tyrese Maxey, Thibault. Like, Thibault had, 5 steals and 4 blocks in 20 minutes?
Oh, God, did he? I didn't even catch that in the box score. Did he?
Yeah. Really? No, no, sorry. 5 blocks and 4 steals. I got that mixed up. Yeah. But he was like, one of only 20 players in NBA history to ever have that stat line in the playoffs. No one had done it in fewer than 35 minutes. He did it in 20.
Good Lord. See, that didn't pop up in the condensed game.
Yeah. Okay. He's just... Wow. I mean, it was just an all-around ass-kicking. I will say this. The Wizards have to stop starting Howell Neto. There is absolutely no point. And Ben, I mean, that was the theme that came up a lot. Throughout all the press conferences last night, I wrote about it for Forbes today. Ben, again, came under a lot of criticism for only scoring 6 points in that first game. And he was saying, look, I just took what the defense gave me. Like, Tobias had 37 points. Joel had 30. Like, I was just making plays for my guys because they were really hot. You know, the Wizards adjusted their defensive scheme and started giving me more space because they were glued to Joe. They were glued to our shooters. So I had more room to operate as a scorer. And I just took what they gave me, and I scored. Like, he had 12 points in the first quarter. He had more points in the first quarter than he did in all of game one. We said...
I'm not going to comment on that because I have a take on that. But
fire. Fire away.
Like, that's just a... I get it. And that's a team-first mentality, which I appreciate. Yeah. But, like, in the playoffs, you can't keep thinking, I'm only going to take what the defense gives
me. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I really want to hammer home this point. I don't hate Ben Simmons. I realize that over the past two podcasts, it sounds like I do. I really don't. I loved what I saw in, granted, the condensed game that I watched, but still, I don't have as much time in the entire world, Brian. But I love the aggressiveness there. I really do. Yeah. I don't understand. But to go from there and just say, well... You know, it's fine that I occasionally score just 4 or 6 points in a game. Like, no. No, you are so good that you should have a certain baseline regardless. I really think that's... I was about to say that's a passive attitude, but I think that's unfair. I don't think that's a passive attitude because you know what? He's so aggressive at defender. He's such an aggressive playmaker. So I think the word passive just be cross off the list. That's not a fair word to use for him whatsoever. Mm-hmm. I think for him, it's just a matter of recognizing you got to go get it. no one's going to hand you things. Yeah. So if your mentality is, I'm gonna take what the defense gives me, like, no. No, if you make the finals and you're up against, like, I don't know, or the Eastern Conference Finals, even when you're up against the Brooklyn Nets, for example, mm-hmm. like, they're going to take everything they can away from you. You can't sit back and go, I'll just wait my turn. No, you got to go grab that shit.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've made this comparison before, and it's not them as play. Like, I'm not saying Ben Simmons is on the level of LeBron James. He is not. But it reminds me of, especially early years, LeBron criticism, because he, yeah. too, would often, you know, say he's just making the right play. Like, he's passing up a potential game-winning shot because a teammate is wide open. You have to live with the results. And, you know, he's saying, like, look, I'm just playing the odds here. Like, you know, this is the right basketball play. And over time, good process is going to beget good results. And that's similar to what yeah. Ben Simmons is, you know, his mentality is and what he's been saying really throughout this whole year. Same with Doc Rivers. Like, Doc has been saying all year, every time a Ben Simmons scoring question comes up, he's like, I don't care. You guys are fixated on it. I'm not. All I want to see is that he's getting downhill. He's getting, you know, he's attacking. He's being careful with the ball. You know, he can use the threat of him as a driver to both score if he's got the space or kick out if he doesn't. And so,
right, and he'll practically always have the space, Brian, yeah. because he's 6'10", yeah. 240.
No, I'm with you. I like the version that they got in game two is what they're going to need moving forward. I totally agree with you that, like, I hear what Ben is saying, too, about, you know,
yeah.
taking what the defense gives you, but at a certain point, especially when you're facing a not overmatched Wizards team, you are going to have to kind of set the tone on your own. And seeing, you know, him being aggressive from the jump was really refreshing last night. You know, do I want him to take 30 shot attempts per game if it comes at the expense of Tobias and Joel? Absolutely not. But
no.
there is a way to make an impact offensively. You know, he did lead the team with 15 shot attempts last night, and, you know, he was a plus 18. He was a plus, I think, 19 in the first game as well, plus 18 as well. So he's just such a confounding player because he can make an impact in so many different ways. But,
yeah.
you know, the Wizards just don't have the guys. Like, Russell Westbrook was the, you know, first play of the game. Russ is on him. He tells Seth Curry to clear out from the paint, and he's like, just go to the corner. And then Howell Neto, like, cheated over to stop Ben, and Ben didn't care at all. And Ben just bullied Russell, like, just plowed through Russ and, you know, had an easy layup. Later in the first quarter, he's one-on-one against Davis Bertans. Bertans flops to try to draw a charge. Ben just, like, walks over him and dunks all over his head. So that's the type of thing where if you're going to guard him one-on-one with overmatched defenders, he needs to go through that. He needs to take advantage of that. Yes. And Joel was saying that, too. He's like, my man was not leaving me last night. So I told Ben, you have all the, I think he's, you have all the space and all the time in the world, so just be aggressive. I think that's kind of the mentality he needs moving forward. But from the Wizards' perspective, dear God, I know we say it all the time, but please someone free Bradley Beal. I feel so bad for him.
Yeah, it's not pretty.
No.
It's really not pretty. But you know what? I respect that he's loyal to the extent that
he is. I do, too.
I really do, yeah. And look, they are going to get better. Obviously, they have the next Giannis on the roster.
I like Rui. I really do. Yeah. I think he...
I do, too. I just never get tired of that joke, though.
I know. All right, let's wrap up with Grizzlies... Utah, and turns out having Mitchell.
I actually want to say, you know what? I would like to take a 20-minute, not now, but later on, I would like for us to take just a 20-minute conversation about Ben Simmons for the YouTube channel. Just you and I hashing it out, because I don't think you and I are far off.
Yeah.
I think you and I are pretty much aligned on most things, and I really want to make sure, because I have a feeling, right, I have a bad taste in my mouth that people who are listening to this podcast right now feels like I'm just crapping all over him, and I really don't, I don't want people to get that impression. So I am inviting you officially to get on the channel with me so we just hash out the entire topic that is Ben Simmons.
I'm totally down for that, and I'm sure... we'll see what happens for the Sixers in the rest of the playoffs, but that will give us plenty of fuel to add to that debate, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Now let's get into Memphis, Utah. Yeah.
Okay. So it turns out having Donovan Mitchell is helpful. He came back in game two. The whole team, I mean, all five of the starters scored a double figures. Clarkson, sixth man of the year, Jordan Clarkson, had 16 points off the bench. Joe Ingles had 14 as well. We got to give credit, though. Ja Morant, 47 freaking points against the Utah Jazz. Yeah. I don't care what happens in the rest of this series. No. That's just sensational. I'm so high on Ja Morant moving forward. Like, my God, Memphis, you have quite a keeper there.
I've been waiting for this,
yeah,
to be honest with you, because like you and I talked about, it seemed like he had moments in the regular season where he played just a little bit more timid, maybe, or was a little bit more, not quite passive or anything, but like, it felt like he left shots on the floor every single night that he could easily take and convert it as well, because he's just that good at consistently getting to the paint and like creating his own shot off the dribble in whatever capacity. Mm-hmm. I've been waiting for this.
Yeah. To do it against Gobert and Utah in particular is just, it's unbelievable. So moving forward more, I mean, this is the version of the Jazz that we thought we would see in game one. You know, they hit 19 threes, and that's not an outlier. This is what they've been doing all year. If like the Grizzlies, if you score 129 points in a playoff game, especially against this defense, like one of the best defenses in the NBA, you got to feel pretty good about yourself. But unfortunately, like this is what makes the Jazz scary this year, is that they have that elite defense, but they could also just, I mean, you know, they hit 19 threes, Memphis hit 8. This was just a math problem. Like Memphis shot 54% from the field, had 38 free throw attempts, hit 29 of them. Like, every single thing would suggest that they should win that game based on those percentages and those numbers, but Utah now is just more multifaceted than it has been in years past.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a hot take. This is the best Jazz team we've ever seen, and I'm including John Stockton, Carmelo.
Interesting. Are you saying that because they're so well balanced?
Yeah, I understand. I am fully recognizing that they don't have the two individual talents to the same extent necessarily. Mm-hmm. Although, and this is where it might get a little bit more hot takey, I think Gobert's defense is that
good. Yeah,
and I think Karl Malone's over a pretty significant portion of his career was kind of overrated as a defender. He made all NBA defensive teams, where I was like, really? Because I watched a lot of 90s basketball. And comparing that to what I see now, especially just the defensive advancements mm-hmm. we're seeing in the NBA nowadays, I mean, I would argue overall that Gobert might be a more influential player overall, just in terms of the raw impact that he has on a team, than a guy like Carmelo. I think, obviously, John Stockton being a two-way player, one of the best, you know, well, the best assist man ever, that he still outranks Donovan Mitchell pretty heavily. Mm-hmm. But those two components of Gobert and Mitchell, just they complement each other in a different way. Where Stockton alone had their pick-and-roll basketball, these two guys just have their end of the floor. Yeah. You know, like they don't necessarily hook up on a lot of plays together offensively and all that. But Donovan is clearly like the main guy on O. Gobert is the star on D. It just kind of works out that they have these components. And can we also like stop soon trying to create like a Shaq and Kobe problem between the two? Mm-hmm. I keep seeing fans like go on to that whack and like I'm not buying it.
No,
I'm really not.
Well, I mean, it came from the bubble last year or pre-bubble. You know, the COVID exposure.
The microphone. Yeah,
But yeah. No, they've both said they've put that long past them. And I don't think that's, especially your Gobert stance, is not completely unfair. Because, like, I don't know if we're, like, aware. We're not talking about these guys legacy-wise because they're all still so young, like Mitchell and Gobert specifically. But, like, Rudy Gobert is not only on a Hall of Fame trajectory, he's on, like, a first ballot Hall of Fame trajectory.
Yes, he is. And honestly, did we make a mistake, Brian, in not talking up Gobert in the MVP category as well?
Yeah, he's, I mean, I wouldn't have put him in the tier of Jokic, Embiid, Steph, even Giannis, but yeah, like, should he get, I mean, I don't know how long the ballot is, probably only five, but, like, should he be in the top 10 conversation in terms of the MVP this year? Absolutely. We've said it time and again. He is the Utah defense. They would not have one of the best defenses in the NBA if not for Rudy Gobert. And I know it's fun and hilarious to make fun of Jazz fans for fetishizing screen assists and things like that, but that is valuable. I keep going back. I keep going back to the piece that Andy Bailey wrote for Bleacher Report, where he spoke to Dennis Lindsay of the Jazz, and Dennis Lindsay is saying, like, look, there are so many things that Gobert does that you can't quantify. And it's, like, similar to what Doc has been saying about Ben Simmons all year. It's like, guys who are elite defenders, again, it just goes back to there aren't metrics to track all of these things. Like, we have blocks, we have steals, now we have deflections and loose balls and charges drawn and all that. But it's still not who's pointing out rotations on the fly or who's calling out defensive coverages. You know, like, there's just a lot that Gobert provides that it's easy to make fun of him, but at the same time, you also have to appreciate how good he is.
Totally agree. And I think overall, balance-wise, this is probably the best we've ever seen. The Jazz, led by Gobert, led by Donovan Mitchell on the other end. I mean, this team has legitimately I really think that Gobert is he's a superstar. Mm-hmm. I really do. It's just in a different manner of what we usually associate superstars with, right? Like, because he's not the self-creator who can create himself jump shots and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And then you have Donovan Mitchell, who's like an all-star caliber talent, who is like on the bubble maybe of a superstar player. But then you have Bogdanovich, Conley, Clarkson, Ingles, Favors, O'Neal, Niang. Like, you have all these guys coming in, providing depth, defense, shooting, specialty play, additional passing. This Jazz team, man, is so damn good that if it doesn't make the finals, I would consider it a great, great disappointment on their behalf.
Yeah, we can end on that note. So it sounds like, I mean, again, if the Grizzlies score 129 and don't win that game, like, we are, with all due respect to Memphis, I don't see them winning this series. I'm, again, super high on a lot of the young guys they have, and I think they have a very bright future, but the Jazz are just firing on all cylinders at this point. I almost wonder, you know, especially if the Clippers get knocked out, are the Jazz the prohibitive favorites in the West right now?
Yes. I don't think there should be a lot of doubt.
Yeah, and that isn't to say that I'm saying, like, the Jazz have a 75% chance of advancing from the Western Conference bracket, because if Phoenix gets healthy, the Lakers are still there, I don't want to bet against Luka, but I mean, but, this is just a really well-balanced team. Like, we were saying all year, like, you boil it down, you know, that you can increase the minutes for their top seven guys. Like, they had their playoff rotation set from the beginning. There is no question of, you know, are we going to mix this guy in and this guy and whatever. It's like, we know exactly what we're getting from this Utah team, and I'm very fascinated to see how their ensuing series play out, especially if it's, you know, a Dallas Lakers path to the finals, which is looking increasingly likely.
I mean, I know who I go with if it's Utah, Los Angeles.
You go Utah?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
You said Twitter. It earlier in this podcast. No, but you said it earlier in this podcast as well. Like, the Lakers didn't set the world on fire.
Offensively, something is still not quite right. And if they play Drummond, it's going to go right into the Jazz's hand. Like, they would have to start Anthony Davis at the five immediately to Oh, man.
And if AT didn't draw, what was it, like 23 free
throws? Yeah. I just think the slander from Lakers fans about Utah has just been voluminous this year. So if the Utah Jazz knock them out in the Western Conference Finals, it'd be like the Utah version of Retweet Armageddon. It would be so funny.
Well, I mean, look, I'm not a fan of the Lakers or the Jazz. I just think when I watch those two teams play at this stage and I went look at their injury history and all that, and depth and competence, I just feel way more at ease with the Jazz than I do the Lakers at this point. Like, that story may not be the same if LeBron hadn't gone down with the ankle a couple a month ago, a month and a half ago? Like, I don't know when it was.
2 months ago at this point? Yeah, yeah, no, I hear you. Fully healthy AD and LeBron, different story, but somewhat compromised.
But they're not, so that's right. And that's why I think this would be clearly the best matchup for the Jazz, because, like, sure, two spanked up superstar and a very, very questionable supporting cast.
Yeah.
Like, let's go feast. Yeah.
Well, it's going to be interesting, and we'll be here the rest of the way for you guys. So thank you all, as always, for listening in today. Please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bios to give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes, wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. Being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. And thanks for listening to our live show on Locker Room. If you liked our show, please be sure to start your own room and engage with other fans on the app. Download the Locker Room app in the Apple App Store to be a part of our podcast. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen. Mort, our next episode, we'll take a brief break from the playoffs to bid goodbye to a few of the play-in teams that got knocked out. We have a special guest for one of them, so hope you enjoy that one as well.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I look forward to our secret guest.
All right, later, man.
Later.